The next matter, number 23-1673, Tiffany Briere v. National Union Fire Insurance Company of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, et al. At this time, would counsel for the appellant please introduce himself on the record to begin?
Your Honors, Michael Sarley for the plaintiffs in this matter. excuse me. We're here today to appeal from the district court's denial of our motion for summary judgment and the granting of summary judgment for National Union in this case. By way of background, on December 1st, 2018, my clients, the appellants, were passengers along with 29 other people in a school bus that for a student had owns and was registered and principally garaged in Rhode Island. The bus was insured by National Union. The bodily injury liability limits were $5 million. The policy was issued.
We probably know the facts well, so you can go ahead and get right to the legal argument.
All right. Our first point, Your Honor, is that there, at the time, there were rules in Rhode Island for all insurance companies doing business in Rhode Island, which National Union clearly was doing. And those rules required that when a claim for UM or UIM coverage was being denied, that all the facts, that is, all the conditions, all the provisions, or all the exclusions being relied upon by the insurance company needed to be stated in the denial letter. In this case, there was one ground and one ground only in the denial letter. That was that the UM-UIM policy had been rejected.
Because it was permitted to be rejected.
Because it was permitted to
so
be
why
rejected.
Why doesn't the permitted incorporate the conclusion that the statute is permissively read to permit them to reject?
Because the statute does not permit them to.
So that would be that they gave the ground, which was that it was permitted. And you're saying they were wrong in that ground because it wasn't permitted.
Correct.
So then the denial letter did give the ground.
Correct.
So then we get to the merits of is it permitted or not, not a waiver ground.
No, I don't think that's true because in Scaling, a Supreme Court case in Rhode Island, this precise issue arose. And in Scaling, the Rhode Island Supreme Court said if a ground is not raised in the denial letter, you cannot, the insurance company cannot use that.
The ground
later.
Raised was that it's permitted to reject it.
But that was clearly wrong.
Okay, so then it was raised. Now we get to the merits of it. If they had simply said, I deny it because the accident didn't occur, they couldn't now say, well, now, under Scaling, I'm rejecting it because of this issued on delivery point. But at the time, what they said is they rejected the coverage and they were permitted to do so. So they could only be permitted to do so if it was lawful under the statute. So that's the argument. They think it's lawful under the statute to reject.
And it was not lawful under
I know.
The
so now we're on the merits. So is it or not?
It is not lawful.
Why not?
Because simply put, there is only one condition that permits coverage, UM-UIM coverage, to be rejected by an insured. And that is if the bodily injury liability coverage is the minimal amount required under Rhode Island law, which is $25,000 per person.
Maybe I'm misunderstanding. Isn't that only true if we read the statutes issued for delivery your way?
You should not even be getting to issued for delivery. Because that is not the issue. The rules applying to all insurance carriers doing business require whatever the issue is for them to raise the issue.
I understand that. I'm assuming they've raised it. Okay? I know you disagree. Assume they raised it.
The issued or issued for delivery?
Yes.
Okay.
Assume they raised it.
Yes.
So isn't the only issue in the case then? Is your reading of issued for delivery right or not?
I think that would be correct if that was proper. But you're saying at the outset, and we say scaling stays.
I understand. That's the waiver point, right?
Because it is.
And I'm asking you to. I totally understand it. If my colleagues want to ask you more about it, they're free to do so. But I'd like to get to the merits of your argument if we don't agree with you on scaling.
Okay. If you don't agree with me on scaling, then with respect to the issue delivery or issued for delivery type of argument, I think there's ample evidence in the case that the intent of this part, the intent of certainly First Student was to have UM-UIM coverage apply because they had contracts, active contracts with school districts throughout Rhode Island, which required them to have $500,000 and $1 million of insurance, UM-UIM insurance. So for First Student to say that was not its intent, that it was going to rely upon an issued or delivered argument to negate that obligation, I think is just not something a court could possibly grant. That's First Student's point of view. With respect to National Union's point of view, it had apparently a different intent. It didn't even know what the contracts First Student had required in terms of UM-UIM coverage. They simply said, as far as we are concerned, they checked the box, and that was good enough. That's what the court said. That's what they were wanting to say in their rejection, because the only thing they did when they sent the denial letter was they enclosed the actual printout of the form where they rejected it. They never at any point got to the issued or issued for delivery.
I may have misunderstood your argument. What is your view of what was meant by permitted in the denial letter?
Permitted in the denial letter was there was a box they could check rejecting coverage. And that's why they enclosed with their denial letter that box, that form, where they checked the box and said rejected.
So
that was the only basis.
Are you saying there are two separate ways in which you cannot provide this coverage? One is if you're not registered or delivering the policy within the state, in which case the rule doesn't even apply to you. That's way one. Way two is if you are delivering the policy in the state, so you can't use way one. However, the insured could be permitted under that situation to reject the coverage if certain criteria are made. That's way two. Is that what you're saying?
I don't think that's quite what I'm saying, okay. Your Honor. I think...
Go ahead. I had a thought about maybe what you were saying, but you would know better than I would.
I think what I was saying, Your Honor, is that the Supreme Court in scaling was faced with a denial of UM-UIM coverage, which it concluded was a breach of contract. Then there was a bad faith claim that was raised. And one of the things that the insurance company tried to do was to bring in a fact that had not been included in the denial. And the Supreme Court said, listen, when you deny a claim, you must give every reason, every condition.
That general principle, I don't think you're getting any resistance on. It's the application of that principle. I'm at least having trouble understanding why saying that this was permitted isn't saying that 27.7-21A permits me not to provide it because the policy isn't delivered within the state.
Because they never articulated that particular reason.
But what could permitted mean other than that? Well, your position is that it's impermissible always to deny because of how you read the statute.
No.
So what could they have meant other than that if they were saying it was permitted to do it?
No. The statute itself, the UM statute, provides there is only one reason that you can reject UM-UIM coverage.
When it applies to you.
Right.
Right. So if they say it's permitted, Your idea is that they imagined it applied and then they had a wrong reason for thinking it was permitted?
Is that the idea?
And then you're saying all the extrinsic evidence supports that understanding of the denial letter?
I believe that is indeed part of the case, Your Honor.
But you're basically saying this case, as a threshold matter, turns on the interpretation of the denial letter.
Yes.
And you're saying it's not plausible to read permitted to mean what they now want it to mean.
Correct.
Because they had, at the time, were acting as if it applied.
Right.
And their ground for saying it was a permissible rejection then was just a mistaken understanding of what they could do under the statute. That's why the testimony from the person who says, I never read it, I didn't know about, that's why that's all matters.
Exactly.
And I get it. So you're saying there's a threshold question about what did the denial letter mean, and that at summary judgment, it could be determined that permitted meant something totally different from on delivery, et cetera.
Right.
So we would never get to the question of whether it is on delivery.
Exactly. Because the statute itself defines when the coverage can be rejected. And that's what they rejected.
So that's what you're, the permitted is kind of a red herring here.
Yeah.
I think you're saying in the insurance denial letter, they need to say why they were entitled to deny. And what they said was first group elected to reject as it was permitted to do. And now you're saying they're not making an argument to us that they get off the hook because first group elected to reject because it wouldn't have been able to.
Exactly.
They're making a whole different argument over here about where it was housed.
A completely different argument.
Okay.
And
you're just saying at least there's a tribal issue of fact about whether the denial letter can be read as you want it to be read.
At the very least.
Yeah.
I go even further, though. I think that under the circumstances that given the way the statute is read and because they were doing business in Rhode Island, the rule for how an insurance company must act when it's doing business in Rhode Island, which it was doing here, was insuring buses. That rule requires all reasons for a denial to be listed. Doesn't matter what the claim is. Doesn't matter whether it's bad.
And you said that's background information that further makes the denial letter hard to read the way they want to read it.
Exactly.
I got it.
And the Supreme Court in Scaling 2, basically said the remedy for this is the court cannot rely upon those extraneous reasons that were not articulated in the denial letter. And they define that basically in the rules as an unfair settlement practice. It's right in the rules about that.
So you're saying, in effect, when you make the claim for this, they can't defend it by saying 2772-1A doesn't cover us because they didn't say that in the letter.
Exactly.
And so there wouldn't even be an issue for the court below, a fact issue at all.
Exactly. And I say the court overlooked all of this because in the court's decision, there is not one mention of why the rules applicable to all insurance companies doing business in the state denying coverage are not applicable. Not a word about that. And the district court also did not distinguish why Scaling was not applicable.
Did it construe the word permitted? I thought it did. Am I misremembering that? That may be just in the briefing. Did the district court construe the word permitted in the denial letter?
No.
I see. That's just in the briefing.
That's in the briefing. There is nothing.
That issue, but did you raise that issue below?
Yes. On page, I think it's 7 and 8 of our memorandum in support of our motion for summary judgment, we raised this whole issue, and including the rule that says they have to put everything in.
Did you raise it in opposition to their motion for summary judgment?
Well, I raised it in support of our motion for summary judgment, saying this is not a tack that mm-hmm. could be taken. This is not something.
Just to be clear, I take it you didn't raise it in your motion.
I don't remember whether we put it in response to their motion, but it certainly was in our motion for summary judgment. In the memo we cited in support of our motion for summary judgment. And the district court didn't say in denying our motion why this rule didn't interfere with her denial of it. Because if my view of the statute was correct in how it had to be read.
Just give you a chance to answer it. If it's not in your motion opposing their motion for summary judgment, and it is in your motion for seeking summary judgment, since we can review de novo whether you'd be entitled to summary judgment as opposed to it being a debatable matter of fact,
right,
we could still affirm the denial of your motion to summary judgment, even accepting this issue. What would that mean then for the question of whether this issue is live as to the denial, as to the grant of their motion for summary judgment? Do you follow?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I am not following. I'm not understanding what you're asking.
Well, they're not symmetrical. If you move for summary judgment, it has to be beyond dispute that you're right.
Right.
So we can affirm the district court on the ground if we thought the record shows it's just a debatable fact. You wouldn't be entitled to summary judgment even if everything you said about what you said about scaling were otherwise true.
Right.
Okay, then separately we have before us the grant of summary judgment to them.
Yeah.
Did you oppose summary judgment to them on the ground that...
Again, Your Honor, I can't remember whether we included it in the briefing on that issue on opposing their summary judgment.
Then we'd sort of be on plain error if you didn't raise that issue to them there, or is that wrong?
I think that would be wrong, Your Honor. I think it would be wrong to permit them to do something that clearly they are not entitled to do and to profit from that. To basically commit what is a violation of rules that they have to adhere to in applying for issuing a denial, and then to say, well, okay, you violated the rules for what you're supposed to do, but now we're going to let you succeed on that issue.
Anything further? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. At this time, counsel for National Union Fire Insurance Company can introduce herself on the record to begin.
May it please the court, Elizabeth Allstrand on behalf of the defendant, National Union Fire Insurance Company. Just to start with the waiver issues that your honors have been raising. So first, plaintiffs never raised below in either in opposition to our motion for summary judgment that there was a question of fact. Both parties have always taken the position that these were legal issues that could be decided as a matter of law in their favor. I would also go back
to... The appendix contains a plaintiff's statement of disputed facts in response to your summary judgment motion. What was that?
What was their statement of disputed facts? They did dispute some of our material facts, but they did not. Most of the facts they said were immaterial to the case. Their whole position really is just simply that...
And didn't they tell the court your denial letter was ineffective to preserve your argument, your coverage defense?
They did argue the waiver issue, but they didn't argue it from the sense that it raised a question of fact that would prohibit summary judgment. They just raised it as we waived the issue, the statute must apply because we didn't specifically reference the word statute in our...
Because they included in their motion for summary judgment, not in opposition to your motion for summary judgment. Is that the reason?
Well, you have to view all of these issues in context. The plaintiffs have always just taken the position that the statute applies and therefore...
There's two different things going on. There's that issue and there's the scaling issue. Scaling issue stands independent of that other issue, right?
Yes and no. So plaintiffs in their request for UIM coverage specifically acknowledged the fact that the policy as issued did not have Rhode Island UIM coverage in it. And they argued in their letter that by operation of the statute, there had to be coverage and that coverage could not be rejected because First Student had more than the minimum limits.
Right, but that's...
We responded to that and said, there is no Rhode Island UIM coverage because First Group rejected it as they were entitled to do. When you read the two letters collectively, there's no other way to read National Union's letter than to say to do it because your argument on the statute is incorrect.
I thought all of the burden of their other evidence was to create a question as to whether you just were wrong in thinking that you could reject it on the ground that you gave. It's true that the premise of that is that they think the statute applies. But in response, the letter doesn't say the statute does not apply. It just says it's permitted. Then they have all this testimony. This person didn't read it. This person had a misunderstanding. All of that would be the kind of thing a jury could then look at and see, does this denial letter, in saying permitted, mean the statute doesn't apply, or does it mean, even assuming it applies, it was permitted to reject it? Of course, they win if it's the latter, but they want that issue before a jury, presumably. That's why they raise all that testimony.
Well, if that's their position on appeal, they certainly didn't articulate it that way to the district court. That argument was never made to the district court. It was simply they didn't raise the statute. They waived the statute. The statute applies. You have to reform the policy to have $5 million in limits. And our position
is... What's wrong with that argument? As I understand their argument is, you're now saying we should rule for you because the policy was not delivered in Massachusetts.
In Rhode Island.
In Rhode Island.
It wasn't issued or issued. It delivered right. or issued for delivered.
And they're saying, you didn't say that in your denial letter. So therefore, under scaling, you lose. That's their argument, as I now understand it.
Well, respectfully, we disagree that when you read the letters in context, that a reasonable reading of our disclaimer letter would not have put them on notice, that our position was that the rejection of the UM-UAM was permitted by law, the law being the statute.
And I understand you're saying the letter did preserve the defense. If it didn't, do you lose?
No, because
why not?
The letter doesn't change the statute. So to invoke the statute, you still have to fall within the statute.
But scaling, I thought, suggests it doesn't matter. You can waive a legal argument.
Well, respectfully, scaling was a bad faith case. The coverage had already been found. There's ample Supreme Court authority from Rhode Island that says you can't create coverage in the first instance by issues of waiver and estoppel. So the arguments that plaintiff's raising, we would only get to if we got to the bad faith elements of this case, and we are nowhere near the bad faith elements of this case. They first have to establish the breach of contract. And on the breach of contract piece, it's the insured, it's the plaintiff who has to establish that there's a policy of insurance, a loss within that coverage, and that we disclaimed the coverage. And so here, they haven't proven that case, and so therefore, we never get to the scaling piece of it. Is my time up, Your Honor?
You have 3 minutes.
How do you never get to the scaling unless we agree with you that the denial letter should be read as invoking the delivery defense?
Again, the statute says what the statute says. The statute only applies to policies that are delivered or issued for delivery in Rhode Island.
Sure, a policy could say what a policy could. I mean, the scaling is not an unusual law. A lot of states, if the denial letter doesn't raise a defense, then the insurer is out of luck. That's why denial letters are so often so long.
Well, it also depends on how you look at the defense. This isn't an exclusion. This isn't a condition to the policy. This is actually what coverage is afforded within the scope, what is covered within the scope of the policy. And in many times, that is not something that's waivable. That is not something that estoppel applies to. And so when we're looking at what coverage there is in the policy, that is what it is, and plaintiffs have to show that their loss falls within that. That's not something that can be waived.
Your defense to us, as I had understood it in the briefs, doesn't rely at all on any rejection of anything by anyone.
Our position is that the statute doesn't apply to the policy, and so therefore it was completely permissible for First Group to reject Rhode Island UM-UIM coverage. And only if the policy was delivered or issued for delivery in Rhode Island and the statute applied would it have been impermissible for First Student to reject the coverage. Impermissible.
So you're saying First Student was offered the coverage and rejected it?
Right. This isn't a situation where sort of the formalities of the process weren't followed. And that's because, as is reflected in our undisputed facts and the affidavit of our underwriter, is that the process is to have, insurers like this that are operating in multiple states to fill out the rejection forms and, you know, in all the states that they're operating, because quite clearly they could have opted to buy more coverage than they're statutorily required to buy. So this is the process that is used. And so they chose to reject this coverage.
How do we deal with scaling? I'm thinking of a denial letter that says we're denying this because the policy doesn't cover it. I would assume that would be no good under scaling because it is just so conclusory.
Due to a lack of specificity?
Yeah, because otherwise you could have one-sentence denial letter for every case in Rhode Island that just says doesn't cover it.
Yeah, one word, denied.
Respectfully, we believe that our letter did have,
how does it go beyond that when it doesn't, and it seems instead of saying it doesn't cover it, it says it doesn't have it as we're permitted to do without explaining why you're permitted to do it.
Again, read in context with the demand for UIM coverage, which clearly invoked the statute to manufacture the coverage that didn't otherwise
exist. But the fact issue I think they're trying to create is whether a jury could find, maybe that's a reasonable way to read them together, but maybe a jury could find, no, the insurance company thought that the statute, there's no statement ever from the insurance company saying the statute doesn't apply, right?
In the letter?
Yeah, or in anything up at the time of that exchange.
That was really the only exchange pre-suit. But the letter, the response letter by the insurance company does not say the word, the statute doesn't apply. But it was responding to plaintiff's letter that said there's no Rhode Island UIM coverage, but there has to be because of the statute. And so when you read them in context, our position is that there is only one reasonable interpretation. Reasonable minds could not disagree. And also, from our position, this wasn't raised as a question of fact below.
One last question. Can you just tell me, on your reading of issued for delivery, what policy is it serving?
Not the additional issued for delivery?
Yeah, but what thing in the world is made better by having your reading of issued for delivery? Is there anything that is sensible about it? I mean, I understand the textual point, and then you say there's some compromise in public choice theory, whatever, but is there a reason any sensible legislature would want to have the system you say the text requires?
I think it's to allow some flexibility between where the policy is actually delivered, which here in this case we know it was in Ohio, and where the parties are really truly intending, and by parties, I mean the parties to the contract intend the policy to be delivered. So, for example, if we deliver it to, in this case, their broker was in New York, but they're not in New York, they're in Ohio.
But I guess why in general would they want it to be where the policy is delivered to, independent of the realities of where they're operating and where the coverage will be? Is there some reason why the place of delivery would be a sensible thing to make the whole statute turn on?
From the legislator's perspective? I think to be consistent with the party's intent. Because delivery can be just actual delivery. I mean, this is where how this case sort of evolved, right? The original assumption by plaintiffs was that this had to have been a policy that was issued in Rhode Island. That's not the case. It was issued and delivered in Ohio. There are certain policies that only become effective upon delivery. This isn't one of those types of those policies.
Okay.
So there's more flexibility to, I think, just be consistent with the party's intent.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. At this time, counsel for First Student will please introduce herself on the record to begin.
Good afternoon, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. Christina Holtman for First Student, Inc. If I may just speak to the last question that you directed to Counsel for National Union, why even have a delivery requirement at all? That reason would obviously be known to the legislature. They could have, and they do in other portions of the statute, require all vehicles registered in Rhode Island to have liability coverage or some financial
security. I understand that point. But
correct.
Is there a reason why delivery requiring it tied to delivery makes sense?
Because it's the intention of the parties to the policy at the time. They could have expanded the scope. Plaintiff's counsel directed you towards rules regarding any insurers doing business in the state. They could have had that language in there.
So no, I guess I'm really asking. I understand the text, and it makes sense, and it's different than other texts, and other texts is broader. So that's its own logic. But is there some reason why a sensible legislature would want to tie the UIM-UM rule to the completely adventitious state of the P.O. box of the recipient?
I think it's stability and predictability for the insurers, Your Honor. There are obviously other statutes cited by, referred to in cases cited by plaintiffs where there's an issue for, without the garage requirement, because it's talking about attorney's fees. It's not every insurance policy issued in this country or every insurance policy issued to a Rhode Island vehicle. We're limiting the scope for the predictability of the insurance party, or the insurance company, I would argue, Your Honor. As for the waiver issue, which was the focus of plaintiff's counsel's argument, as a matter of record, First Student's only a party is to count three, the DJ count. The scaling rules or the rules about denial letters that apply to insurance companies certainly don't apply to First Student. And the demand letter was not addressed to First Student, although they did receive a copy, but it certainly wasn't responded to by First Student. So that waiver argument that plaintiff's counsel focused on didn't apply. Plaintiff has tried to, throughout the course of this case, conflate the scope of the inquiry to the entire insurance universe or the entire First Student universe. What is before this court is one policy and one policy only, and that's 192.1809, and what coverage is afforded under that policy. Although briefly, you know, in their briefs before this court, they somehow argue that the contract is ambiguous. That certainly wasn't something they argued before, and for the reasons cited in our brief, that contract isn't ambiguous. The only other inquiry for the court then is whether the contract or the statute requires that there be such coverage. If the statute doesn't apply and the policy is in conformance with the statute for that reason, there is no coverage and the motion for summary judgment or the granting of the motion for summary judgment has to be affirmed. So the only issues are, is there insurance coverage within the policy? And the answer is no. And is the statute apply such that the policy must be reformed? And I know Your Honor was well-versed on the textual issues if you had any questions about that. However, plaintiff's counsel now argues that, well, we must have intended to go purchase it because we had these other contracts. That's not relevant to the issue of what coverage is provided under 192.1809. That isn't germane to the issue of what the legislature intended in including a delivery requirement in that statute or an issued for delivery requirement in that statute. You know, not to be glib about it, Your Honor, but if my son asked me for a glass of milk, and I tell my husband I'm going to go to the store to buy milk, and I leave the house intending to go buy milk. When I get to the store, I tell the shopkeeper I want a loaf of bread. My son might be upset. My husband might ask me to go back to the store, but that bread doesn't suddenly become milk. Any intent or those other contracts can affect, those unilateral acts by First Student can affect the coverage in the policy that was issued by National Union. Unless your honors have any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes argument in this case.